Okay, let's get started. And tonight, it's Wednesday night, it's 7 o'clock, and this is the Hidden Work Show. What we're doing is we're working our way through a number of books by E.J. Gold, and this particular one is The Hidden Work. We are currently on Chapter 12. It appears that we will probably be on Chapter 12 for the rest of our lives, and possibly the lives of our grandchildren. But that's the case. But there's a reason why. And the reason is that this book, in part, is to introduce to us the concept of prayer absolute. The book, the first 10 chapters of the book, in a sense, get us ready to accept the idea of the prayer absolute. The knowledge that we're working with in these classes and the knowledge that we've been working with over these last several weeks, this is not knowledge that is that simple to access. The spaces that we're looking for, Ivan and everybody, is they're unique. And we're looking for a commonality of that space. We're accessing objective spaces that everybody can reliably discuss. Aria, did you just feel that? Stay aware, okay? Stay on your toes.
I think my phone is cutting out. The sound is not, because you're not hearing some of my answers.
Okay. The Aria tonight is taking over the post of both of reading the log and helping bring the conversation that's going on the log to us here so that we can incorporate that as part of our conversation. If you go to the website, which is wingsofchaos.com under the Hidden Work on Chapter 12, you're going to see a number of recordings, and you're also going to see a number of the class logs. So as I was saying, chapters 1 through 10 help us, in a sense, get to prepare the ground for receiving, beginning to receive that information. We are the ground that is in preparation. We are that ground. And it took us this many years to be ready to receive the information that we have been able to receive. And Silverdale and I have had this conversation many times. We've read these books a number of times each. And both of us realize that as you go through the books again, more is there. And the reason is because you have depth, and there's more depth. Silverdale's working extensively with his activating the essential self. As that explodes, then what happens is that more can come in. I don't know if you can access my email that I sent out, but in the email there were three remarkable quotes from the log that I brought up, that I posted in the email. The first one was from Jim H. And in that quote, he says that the human biological machine is too small for this data. And only when you can get in access into the the essential self can you begin to receive this kind of information. And when you're in this space and you can sense that, then you know that that is so, that is the case, that in the normal constraints of your everyday life, you just ain't big enough. You have to have a bigger field of vision in which to incorporate that which we are speaking of now. Turn your speakers down, too, on your computers.
Are on the phone.
Yeah. Silverdale follows by using a really wonderful term, a mature essential self, maturing the essential self. So, you know what, I'm not quite sure what he meant by it, but when you are more practiced at being in these spaces, then it's possible to hang out there. When it's possible to hang out, then there's simplicity of being able to hear what's going on there. There's some background noise that's going on, somebody out there, so let's try to mute that.
Let me just say, David, that I really liked the this post that Jim H. entered on your Winds of Chaos also.
Yeah. Can you say something about it?
Yeah. If you could, I just happened to read today Jim's comment about joining all of the parts of ourselves together. You know, that EJ is, I'll just have to paraphrase, better off reading what Jim wrote. You know, that absorbs all of his teaching in all of his many facets that EJ is presenting as a method, pathway to rejoining the fragments. You know, it's like it reminded me of the broken vessels in Kabbalah. It's like the human biological machine would not be adequate for the unification of all of these, let's say, forgotten or lost or sleeping parts of ourselves. I thought it was a good formulation. I liked what he wrote.
Right.
You know, especially, you know, going along with the octave, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could think of, you know, various practices that you do for other beings and some that you do for all beings everywhere, and all of those as having a certain force at various parts of your own personal octave. So, you know, of propelling any one of us towards the work, towards an octave that's on a different scale.
Could you articulate that again, Ivan? I thought that was very interesting. I had this background noise somehow interfered with my
hearing.
Oh, you had
background noise? Yeah, I'm just.
I hear something going on in the background. I'm not sure what it is.
Oh, is that's the ranch? We're hearing something at the ranch?
No. I'm here by myself.
It strikes me that what Jim wrote, you know, I seem to relate it to the octave, to this study that we've been doing for weeks on the octave, that the fact that EJ recommends a whole variety of practices, whether it's tarot, working with the tarot deck, working with music, watching old movies, running orbs. You know, and some of these practices, people are running orbs through the Labyrinth Reader Society. You know, for other beings, there are certain exercises that you do if you can remember yourself or remember to do them. I can remember to do them, for instance. You know, I would dedicate those practices for the benefit of all beings everywhere. And so I'm just thinking that there's, you know, those could be all contributing to my moving through an octave, a personal octave, and somehow interfacing it or pushing it towards another octave or another scale, you know, of working on a scale that's more in line with a school. You know,
so other people's work can energize our own movement.
Yeah, like what David is talking about, spaces. There are spaces that are very, you know, that I can't find, or it's very difficult for me, let's say, to invoke my presence to the extent, you know, that we do, let's say, here once a week. With this group of people, we have the opportunity to work in a different octave. Process.
This is very much like a musical practice where the band gets together and practices.
Yeah, which we do, yeah.
Which we are doing And the last of the three quotes that I put into the email was, I don't know if Hawk Lady is on tonight or whether she'll remember having said this. In essence, she says, we'll take our shoes and fly. And that reminded me very much of Genesis, that quote from Genesis 3:5, if you'll recall. And then in there...
Which one is that, David? Remind us.
That's where God says, he says, loose your shoes, said God, for the ground upon which you stand is holy. And when I read that many years ago, what I realized is he's saying, take that which is common off. Loose your human biological machine and stand, therefore you know, on holy ground. We're talking about transit, moving from one space to another space. And what you're doing is you're moving, you're coalescing these three parts of the human biological machine and moving into the sacred space of the essential self. At that time, when we stand within this sacred space, we do fly, as Hawk Lady said. We do. That's exactly what's going on. So that's the how we get to, in a sense, we get to being allowed now to be introduced to the prayer absolute. Because there's enough space within us, right? You know what I mean? The space, we are big enough to now get the prayer absolute. But now we come to chapter 11 and we read the prayer absolute. And the nine lines that we've worked on together, we read these, and these are become part of us in a certain particular way. In chapter 12, EJ unpacks the prayer absolute. And there's so much there to unpack, and that's why it's taken us 8 weeks to get to this part of it. And there's that much material in it. And he shows how it does relate to the work of the octave. And there was the, I think it was George that said, we work our way up the octave,
Climbing the octave.
Climbing the octave.
I bet there are comments.
Aria, do we have anything?
No, not really. Right now, the only thing that's posted was Hawk Lady's quote from Exodus 3:5. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. So she had posted that just before you brought it up.
Really?
Exodus 3:5. Check that out.
And that's excellent. That's really cool. I'm glad she did that. The timing was perfect. And that reminds us, of course, of J.D. Salinger as well, where J.D. Salinger has this mythical family called the Glass family, living in New York City. And the chief character in the Glass family, if you know this, is Seymour Glass. And he's an enlightened individual. And he said, you know what, it just seems like we're moving from one holy place to another throughout our day. Okay? How about that one? You think, so if we can keep that in mind, that kind of thing in mind, the space is then open for us to begin reciting the form of prayer absolute. So prayer absolute, Ivan, it has a form. Mm-hmm. All right? It has a form. I'm going to share something. It's a little embarrassing, but I'm going to share it. And I don't. So I dream, okay? Some people have dreams. I don't know if you have dreams. No, not.
Probably most of us do.
Most people seem to have dreams, Ivan is telling me. And so I had this dream. And in this particular dream, I was in intense conversation. The mood was like this, just moving very intently is all I can say. It felt like it took a lot of energy to move in this space, and we were communicating, and he was showing me certain things, and then he said, and he looked at me, and as if he was demonstrating things to me, okay? He was showing me different things in this particular dream. And what he said was, he says, well, ultimately then, like, foregone conclusion of like, duh, says, ultimately then, it's all in the feeling, isn't it? So what I took that to mean is that our way of navigating through prayer absolute is all in the feeling, but we have to access the higher emotional center. This is not our reactive non-emotions that come through in the human biological machine. This is the, as George has said so many times, you know, the vibratory sensation of the higher space. When you're there and you're practiced in it enough, it becomes, it's the vibratory sensation that is your guide. As we spend more and more time in that space, then other things are possible. For example, when you are more active in that higher space, one of the things, you'll begin to see things that you should or shouldn't be doing. It, you know, tasks that are suddenly before you. It may be somebody calls you on the phone and says certain things, and you recognize it not as a linear thing, but something else that needs to be done. And maybe they need a little help, but someone else has to deliver the help, right? We don't know the effect of that. And sometimes you give the help just because your sensing says to give the help. Does this make sense?
Yes.
Does that make sense, Aria?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I heard you. And it does make sense. And the reason it makes sense is we have to decouple from the linear cause and effect that we're used to. Because the linear cause and effect is, oh, I'll do this and I get this in return, right? But how about if you do something and nobody knows you did it, which is okay, right? But you do it because it needed to be done in that space. Mm-hmm. All right? I'm not talking about, it's a different set of rules.
Well, you have to use your intuition.
Well, your intuition that we're talking about, Susan, is exactly right. But this is the intuition that we develop in hanging out in this higher vibratory sensation, and then it becomes a guide. You know, you're working diligently in developing it to a very fine degree right now for very particular purposes, and it's honing very well, very nicely. Yeah.
I was going to just add, I find that when you can be in those spaces, then you do, like you said, you're just directed to know what needs to be done, even if no one's watching. You just know that that's, you're directed to do it.
So we'll leave the conversation about directed to do something for another time, but I am underlining what Susan said. All right.
Sensing is involved there also.
A very high degree of sensing. Sensing isn't on or off. Sensing is a gradation it gets better and better and better the more you work at it. But you got to work at it. Now, how do you work at it? You say, well, maybe if I do this, I can work at it. No, you got to work at it all day long. Like Seymour Glass, you know, he was leaping from holy place to holy place. It didn't matter to him. It just didn't matter because it was so imbued in his lifestyle, because he was always standing there, as Spinoza says, as it were, seen through the eyes of God. So when we start to invoke this, and George, I think this is where we start to this interplay with the absolute, I come to thee, and then, but there's an invocation as well, right? Is the invocation where our openness, we have prepared the right fertile ground to receive something. And when the fertile ground is prepared, sowing of seeds occurs, I'll tell you.
Yeah, David, what we discover is that the absolute actually permeates ourselves, and we permeate the absolute, and we develop presence in order to sense that awareness of the absolute within ourselves as well as outside of ourselves. That's the importance of developing our essential, the presence of our essential self in order to be able to sense that. It takes a lot of practice.
It takes a lot of practice, and you've always used the term over the years that at a certain point, the balance between the historical personality and the essential self, suddenly the balance shifts, and there's a different, as I assume, to use the Gurdjieffian terms, the master has returned. And when the master has returned, then it's a different life. Your life actually becomes different at that point. It's a fundamental change that occurs then. That is not a change of, oh, you know, you can think better now, and or you cleared up all these emotions and, you know, you're exercising a little so your health is better. It's a fundamental change because the core, the ground upon which you stand becomes different. Does this make sense?
Well, and again, just to remind you, David, how EJ expresses it in HBM, we have a finer electrical field within a more dominant electrical field. And part of what we're attempting to do is to shift the center of our attention and the center of our gravity to a sensing of that more refined vibratory or electrical field of our essential self and feed it while seeking to minimize the dominance of this the electrical body of our physical body. And in that way, we begin to develop presence that has a much finer sense of other dimensions.
So that's exactly what we're working on now. We're working to create the ability to work with this particular type of intuition that is Susan is saying. I hesitate to use the word intuition only because it's I want a word different than, you know, we're talking about in life.
Yeah, well, let me make a comment about that. What comes to mind for me is that the, you know, we say, for example, that, you know, women's intuition. I mean, it's like this intuition is supposed to be like a talent, like an inborn skill or something like that. And I think it's there's a very distinct difference with EJ's use of sensing. Sensing is a process or a function, you know, related to the, you know, those tools of the essential self, which is the attention and presence. And I think that he's, in my understanding, that sensing is something that you, it's not necessarily inborn, it's something that you can work on, you develop, you can practice, you can exercise
sensing.
Sensing
is the other word.
Say again?
Sensing is the other word.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, Susan. Yeah.
It's not intuition. It's sensing what needs to occur in whatever space.
Well, I think that when we are in presence, we are able to perceive more or to receive more information. That
yeah.
It's always there. We're just not, it's like out of our visible spectrum. And when you, when you're in presence, it be, your spectrum of visibility widens. So you're able to see and receive more information.
The world actually changes at that time. You actually change reality. It's weird to say, but it's because of what, part of what you're saying, Arya, is that you're seeing between things rather than, let's say, the physical attributes of it. You see this more, this finer electrical vibration that the Silverdale was talking about. You're looking from those sets of eyes. When you're looking from those sets of eyes, that which is around you looks, you begin to see it differently. It is truly different. It's alive. It's fun. It's frightening sometimes. You know, I'm a big fan of the... Go ahead.
So, what I was going to say is a lot of people think of intuition as like kind of a like a psychic phenomenon, like I pick up the phone before it rings. But when you're sensing, when you're perceiving more information, it's like you're able to see a different way of communicating. You're seeing different signals, and
yeah.
you're hearing different things. You're receiving information, and so you're just, what may look to someone who is not in that same state of presence as intuitive or psychic, to us, it's like it's just another way of picking up a phone. It's, you're just responding to new stimuli, to new information. You're just seeing it and responding to it. And it becomes very natural once you start understanding how you receive and perceive the new information.
It's only natural if the state in which you, from which you perceive becomes natural to you.
Right. Yeah.
This is all about creating this new ground that Hawklady hinted at last week. It's creating this new ground upon which we can stand. It is possible to do that, and it is possible to develop these strengths, okay? You're using the term, you know, you're born with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying we're born with the potentiality toward it. But look where we are now. We have moved. There's actually been movement in this small group of individuals that's here.
It's work. We're constantly using the word work in our tradition. So there's work, you know, there's work to do to get to this point, and there's work to do to proceed. So.
I'm going to read just briefly from the book on page 129. Middle paragraph. Normally, and some of this we've gone over before, normally we can only journey through this tunnel in creation in one direction, from what we call the past toward what we call the future. But if we withdraw from the whole form of the fourth dimension, other dimensions become available. And Arya, that reminded me of these different, in the Castaneda material, the different, was it gates?
Yeah.
That's what it reminded me, is that when you are loosed from the regular fourth dimension, then you can have the ability to go through those different gates. Like he was talking about, you go through, to me it was very visual, where he, in one case he said, you wake up into the dream, and then maybe you'll see in the dream, you'll see a picture on the wall, a painting on the wall, and that becomes a portal to another gate, another dimension. That's exactly how it works. That when you get into the particular space, and you're in the space, you wind up being in the space that you should be in. The elements that are in that space are the elements that are meant to be there. I know it sounds trite, but it is so true. And then you see that they transform from being picture on the wall to a portal, to an actual portal.
David, there's a couple comments and questions.
Go for it.
Pascal was wondering if remote viewing was similar. And
yes.
Silverdale responded saying, is remote viewing sensing one aspect of the latent possibilities of a developed presence?
Remote viewing is just uncoupling from the normal, which I cannot do. But there's other things that I seem to be able to do, but I can't do that particular one. But it's uncoupling from the need to be attached to the way that the normal perceptions work. Let me expand on that just a little bit, okay? For instance...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. For instance, I seem to have a tangible sense of individuals in this class. Like I'm very, very much, particularly with Susan and Aria, I don't know what it is, but I have a magnetic sensation of those individuals. All right? And when I've been on the phone with them, it's directly, individually, it's magnified. Susan's 1,500 miles away. And Aria, God knows where she lives, on some planet.
Mm-hmm.
True.
It's elsewhere in the universe.
Oh, that's called Southern California?
Yeah.
I see.
That's that other planet. Yeah.
Anyway, so how could that possibly be? It could be my imagination. Yet, there is evidence in those encounters where there seems to be an objective validation back and forth as to that connectivity. So, Pathworld, if I can connect in such a way electrically, I can connect with that electrical sensation with those individuals, then space is not the critical factor, is it? It's not, distance isn't the critical factor. The critical factor is the electrical connectivity that we have worked on developing. And so if you take that same ability and you go into, you can take it to another level and interpret it visually, then you can do remote viewing. And remote viewing has been documented. So it does seem to occur, and I think that's somehow the mechanism.
Yeah. I have a comment, maybe relevant. I'm reminded of the qualities of lucid dreaming, and I haven't done much work with lucid dreaming, but I've had a few dreams, a few experiences where I felt very distinctly, in the horizontal sleep state, that I was sensing, that I was out of the body and looking around, at some particular things. And my thought about that is that there's the reason that I was convinced, that those were lucid dreams is that there's a very different quality of being rummaging around in my own, brain, front brain thoughts, feelings, what's left over from the day, debris, fantasy, drives, all the human biological machine. The lucid dreaming to me was more like sensing. It's like having this peculiar experience of being of traveling around and sensing something very clearly and being located, moving through, you know, not psychic worlds, but a physical surrounding from where I was sleeping, for example. You know, so that's, to me, that's sensing. You know, the lucid dreaming involves sensing, whereas the usual dreaming, you know, most of the dreaming that I do involves associating.
Associative thinking.
Yeah, it's just a front brain thinking. It's like there's certain biological functions that are being carried out when you're asleep.
How do you like that as a distinction, Aria, between the two types of dreaming?
Can you say it again? I think I missed part of it.
Let me just connection. It seems to me that what, you know, I have very little understanding of remote viewing, but I've had a couple of experiences as a dreamer, you know, that I was actually going out and perceiving, you know, what this field looked like next to the house where I was sleeping, and, you know, a couple of things like that. And so having had those experiences, of course, which I could never convince anybody there who was very scientific that I have any evidence that was actually lucid dreaming, but that I was actually seeing that stuff. But, I mean, to me, like having had that experience, oh, okay, if I worked on it or if I had somebody train me extensively, that would be in that direction I could go to remote viewing. You just learn to do it standing up during the day rather than in this intermediate zone of horizontal sleep where the mind is free of the body, let's say.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think it's very close. I've had dreams where I've been able to sense things that were, in fact, you know, very accurate. I think it's very close, and I think it's just an extension of it. I think we just do it easier in that state. We're out of our way.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. We're out of our way. The HBM is more pacified during that period of time, so more is possible. But if your presence is more developed, it will naturally take over in this form of lucid dreaming. So instead of the associative dreaming, which is the worries of the day, you actually wind up in a different space, and that's what becomes more prominent.
David, I would like to offer something that may be helpful. I have been to a workshop on remote viewing, and the fellow who taught that was saying that normally our active brain, the chatterbox brain, is taking over, busy providing emotional overlays and interpretive overlays on what sense. And the secret there was to have the controller call it out, that if you're going into an experience and you're talking about what you are directly sensing, they will call you every time you make an interpretive overlay. Well, that means this, and they'll call you so that you get back on track to staying attuned to precisely and only what you're sensing, if that helps.
Interesting. Yeah, so that's a way of developing your discernment between the two types of spaces. And, you know, I wanted to do a certain thing with some individuals.
Right.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to do with a couple of individuals is literally walk around during the day, but with the intent of walking around in this other space. In other words, you're not just going to the zoo. You're setting out on this inner adventure, which means that you're forcing yourself, in a sense, to stay in that space as you move throughout it and look with those fresh eyes. Very possible to do that.
David, that would seem to be similar to the relationship between not knowing anything and then, as a result, being open to everything. You see the spaces between things and events.
Yeah, and that's what we that's part of our practice here, is for that to become a natural part of how we work, so that our work becomes how we operate during the day. That it's not just during the Wednesday night class or something like that. So let's just read on a little bit. Inevitably, we are mostly drawn back into the worm at the point we left off, if we are still seducible, all right? If we are still seducible. Or, check this out, if we have decided to devote ourselves to the service of the Absolute by voluntary return to the life again and again, endlessly with the aim of the endless perfection, as a diamond cutter cuts a diamond, taking more imperfection away at each passage. Now, we can say that, you know, we say, oh yeah, I want to do that. You know, it's kind of cool. I think that would be nice on my resume. I'm of service to the Absolute and to all beings. Okay? I'm going to put that on my resume and see, on my business card. And you know, so it sounds cool to just say that, right? But part of the purpose of this work and all these chapters that we're working our way through and the exercise, so that we can get ourselves to a place in which we can actually say that. And I know that, you know, a few weeks ago, I had that in one of the emails. At the end of the email, it says, to find ourselves in a place where we can actually say, for the benefit of all beings everywhere. And one person responded back, saying, actually said that back. And the point of that is that there's there's like a fear and trembling when you can see that broadly. When you can see as broadly as that, to want to be of service to all beings everywhere. It's frightening to stand there. It's scary. So can we expand ourselves enough such that we can say that? But you have to pay a little bit of a price to be in that space, so that it becomes more than just another line item in your resume, but as Susan says, in a certain way, we're compelled to work in that manner.
It seems the risk would be you would start excluding groups.
Excluding?
Of people, excluding people that you wouldn't think you would be of benefit to. I don't know, to fully be of benefit to all beings, you have to be totally open to all beings.
Yeah, but you're not in Oslo, Norway either. You're in Denver, Colorado. So certain beings are going to come, you're going to cross those paths. So once again, it's more, where do you stand internally, Susan? Because you don't know if it's the person delivering the mail or if it's the next person that is at the grocery shop. And that if you're in that particular space of service, which is very delicate, it's not human, anyway, when you're in that space, you'll know what to do.
Yes.
The Absolute, and this next phrase is very interesting. The Absolute is the non-manifested presence of the universe. If we look, it has nowhere in which to manifest. It's just there. And then contemporary science cannot measure it. Although this presence exists more objectively than organic matter, there's no way to measure it by standards. We understand that. The presence of the Absolute does not know its nature. It cannot see itself. So, can you see yourself? I think we've talked a little bit about this idea. Who are you? You know, like, who is... Who is the individuals? Who is Aria? I can guarantee that for the most part, she does not see herself. Who is Susan? Who is Silverdale? And Harry and Ivan and David? When you pose the question of who am I, and you sit with that for a while, you'll be quite taken with that phrase. Know thyself. So the Absolute is sitting just in presence. It's not reflecting on itself in a certain way. There's not a reflection like, oh yeah, I'm the guy that's talking to you. Yeah, that one always got me. There's no mirrors in there. So Janet's out there saying, she's carrying on, and she says, we are the mirror of the Absolute. We're the mirror. And only when we open up enough and acquiesce to our position as an essential self, that then the Absolute has a place in which it can see itself manifest.
What does it mean in this paragraph?
Which one?
The same one, the top paragraph on 130.
Yeah.
Even the first Adam cannot see himself, only the second, who is a reflection of the Absolute. That means the second Adam.
I don't know that I can successfully answer that properly.
A reference to something in Genesis? It's a reference to something in Genesis, and then there's a very highly developed, you know, esoteric interpretations of it, which I'm not very familiar with it either. But what I understand, you know, from this passage, it's saying that the first Adam is not something that looks like a human being with two arms and two legs and a head and so on, because the first Adam contains Eve. It's like a different entity. It's like saying that the being that was first created to be in the garden or first created, along with the other animals and plants and so on, was something of a different shape, a different nature.
Part of the problem there, Susan, is that if you look at the tree of life, we're at the very bottom of it. There are entities all up that tree of life, and in that paragraph he's talking about the first manifestations that occur. That is so far above what we can conceive of as an entity, that it's hard for us to know it. Yeah.
I have a question about that one. When I first read it, my first thought was, when he's talking about the first Adam, who contains Eve in himself, to me that was the union of polarities. It's like you have the male, female, the negative, positive. And when it's contained within itself, when you have both polarities together, united, there is no reflection. It's one being. But when you split the polarities and you have a second Adam without the contained Eve, then you have the two endpoints, the two that can reflect. Is that right?
I'd like to just throw in, actually, in the New Testament, Jesus is referred to as the second Adam. So what we do is we start off our evolutionary processes in the garden at conception. We go through a whole series of historical events until finally we perfect ourselves as a second Adam. That is, Jesus made in the image of God, a reflection of the absolute. I think that's what that reference is to.
Okay, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense, George.
And don't forget that the Christ consciousness sits in Tipperess, which is, you know, it's a very high place on the Tree of Life. We're touching stuff on some big stuff. But I like the way that you put it, Aria. I like that a lot. That seems to make conceptual sense. You know, Chokmah and Bina as those manifestations, then there is a male and female. And maybe then, because there's polarity, there's a point of reference. Well said.
Of course, then the rest of this paragraph, there's a very esoteric idea here about the...
Go ahead, Aaron.
At the same time, it is only the absolute presence which is aware of the fact that creation renews itself every 7 days. And then these are ordinary days, but not as you experience them. If we know anything, we will find our way into the beginning day of each new creation. When creation begins the cycle, the church is the place to be. So, what do you get out of that passage?
Well, what I got out of it when I read it was that if you are standing in that space, you can begin to see the rotation of creation. Every once in a while you see people say, gosh, things really seem to be changing right now. And I think that's what they're picking up. They're picking up this renewal, this cyclical part of what's going on. So it's going on. There be it. I mean, I don't know more to say than that. Is Tom, are you on the phone? Okay, I'm not hearing him if he's on the phone.
Hello?
Is that Tom?
Yep.
Okay. How's this working for you?
Well, I think I should investigate and try to figure out if I can do it a little more cheaply, because just doing it with long distance might be a little bit expensive. So.
Oh, if you're on the long distance,
that's right.
You should get off. Go. You should not do it. It's too expensive. Some people have these plans where it's just $20, and then it's you whatever it is. You have unlimited long distance, but if you don't have that, this will be too expensive for you. Okay.
Yeah,
so, it's okay,
so I'll try to figure that.
Even now, if you want.
Okay, I'll try to figure it out. Okay.
Taking a shot at it, though, okay?
Okay, Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and maybe if I don't know what's going to happen next week yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Tom.
Yep.
David, what about the seven-day creation cycle being the key to prayer absolute? Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, Harry, I just wanted to, what I just thought of, in relation to this last short paragraph that I just read is just that it suggests to me that the week that we ordinarily live through, you know, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, with the either the Saturday is the Sabbath or the Sunday is the Sabbath, depending on your persuasion. But that's part of what EJ may be saying here is that the that's like an analogy. It's like a representation of the 7 days of creation. It's not a week. It's not the same week as the week in Genesis. You know what I mean? But it's
that 7 day cycle.
It's a reminder. It could be a reminder of it, for example, or it could be an image of it.
Well, could the time frame for each individual vary?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have no idea. That I certainly don't have an answer for. I think that elsewhere in EJ's explanations, you'll find the suggestion that there's a creation and a destruction cycle that you can sense with each breath.
Yes.
So, you know, the time part of this is very malleable. It's quite elastic. You know, the cycle of a new creation could be happening in an hour, in a day, in a breath, in a weekend, in a process that you're doing, say, baking bread or playing music. Anyway.
Thank you.
Dan was talking about how EJ is interpreting this now through the use of Second Life, where he's developing a whole set of activities, and he's talking in terms of like how in that Second Life work, you know, there's things are, you know, you look at your monitor is in a sense the creation.
You walk in a certain direction, buildings start to appear.
Which it is being a second ago.
Right.
So
Dan is saying you can tell that this is a construct because of how it shows up. EJ saying that the universe is like that, but we just don't know it because it's done in such a way that we don't detect it. Every time the attention of the Absolute passes through the creation, could be like a refresh on the computer, where it revives the image for a few more seconds or for another cycle.
Yeah.
I think it still goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning about sensing. When he says an ordinary day is an eternity, it's experienced with accelerated consciousness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Experienced subjectively, it must seem like a very short time. So it's where we are in our presence, our ability, our level, our chamber, our space, is going to have a huge effect on the duration or the length of that cycle, that eternal moment.
We've all had the experience of, you know, where the stages went by really fast. Or the opposite
right.
One where, gosh, this day took forever. And it all has to do with the difference about what Arya is saying is like the amount of attention we have as we go through our day in particular moments is what kind of determines its length.
Mm-hmm. But it's also possible to influence this as a practice, as a group of people, or with a group of people, because this is reminding me that there is a practice that's been done here in this community for Easter Sunday, which is to say we used to have as part of our Easter observance before an Easter, before anything like an Easter dinner or an actual gathering of the community, it was a karma yoga day. And the idea was that as close to sunrise as possible, we would come and begin doing that karmic task for the day, whether it was gardening, you know, pulling weeds,
building,
moving bricks, building something, cleaning the house, preparing the a dining room, preparing the space for an Easter dinner or whatever. And you know, the reason this came to mind is with what was it, Arya or Hawk Lady just said?
Arya.
Arya. Yeah. That though I distinctly remember because we were how would I say that? EJ incited us, you know, or instructed us to look upon this Easter day as the only day, you know, as a day in eternity.
Right.
And it's to be as quiet as possible, let's say, to not chatter and talk among ourselves, let's say, and other things, basically to invoke presence. And, you know, I can remember doing this practice and feeling that this was an immensely long day. It was a tremendous, like, it was a very dilated sense of time. And I would usually choose to do something like to work in the garden. And it's I can still remember some of the sensations that I had, you know, digging in the ground and pulling up weeds and dealing with the garden for seemingly, in other words, it seemed like a whole lifetime. It was like a lifetime spent in this task. And then we would all begin, then it would be like the Dharma bell rang, you know, and we would all gather from these karma yoga tasks and sit down, you know, at an Easter dinner, at an invocational dinner, and just sort of look around at everybody at the table, and it was sort of like what David's talking about. We're like, we were already in an altered space.
Right.
You know, everybody was experiencing this extended, this eternal day, or to some extent or other. So I feel like, so what I'm saying is, I think that you can, this is a practice that you can, that I could do myself. You know, I could try doing this if I'm staying at home and cleaning or cooking or preparing to entertain people in the evening, to have something like an invocational dinner. But I mean, also as a group, like this group here, you know, we could invoke this state of mind.
Arya, are there any comments right now?
No, nothing relevant to the discussion, just the highs. And Simon was going to cover the chat next week.
Okay. So what I wanted to, let's try something now. What if, we did this between now and next week, Ivan, that we experimented with that on our own? It could be in your regular workday where you set off that workday with the intention that it's going to be a karma yoga day, where you're going to, your intention is simply going to be, this day is going to be for the benefit of all beings everywhere, and you begin the day with that intention, and you renew the intention as the day unfolds, and see what the day is like. Measure it in terms of, was this a long day? Did it go by quickly? What was it like? But isolate a day and attempt to do that during this week. Everybody, not just everybody, do it. And see,
and would
if
that
you
include
can,
preparing this space? Like Ivan was
saying. Do it however you will do it. I'm not, if for you it's working, you know, in a particular physical home space, that might be okay. Arya might get up and get in the car and go to work.
Probably it involves an invocation of presence.
You will begin with an invocation of presence, and a prayer of intention that you put out there that I am now going to do this on this particular day, and you go forth and do it. Whether you're going to have business meetings, lectures that you have to give, or you're just by yourself all day. You're working with others, you're going to a yoga class, you're taking your karate class, whatever it is.
You know, another way to think of this, David, might be to think of it as also like running an orb.
Yeah.
This is what it is. It's like this is the orb. Yeah, this is the orb I'm going to run. I'm entering into this orb from another dimension, from outside. Now this is the orb that I'm entering into, and I'm going to run this orb today, and I'm going to do it with as much presence as possible. And maybe I'm running it for so and so, or I'm running it for other beings.
You could do it for
the
other
benefit
beings,
of other beings,
or you might do it for a particular being. Like for instance, let's say. Are you still in school?
Yeah.
Classes are still happening? So let's say you decided that for you, you're going to try to do it on a school day. You might decide to do it on the weekend or whatever, but whatever, you just decide to do it. You're going to wind up doing exactly the same tasks, aren't you? You're going to get in your car, you're going to feed the dogs, whatever the heck, get in the car, you drive over to school, and you have your ritual that you do, but you spice it with this, like, I call it fear and trembling, because this awe that you bring to it, and you're going to do the same tasks. Maybe you're a programmer, and you're going to be programming for 2 or 3 hours, or whatever you do, you know, and you know you're going to do it, but you're doing it from this point of view, for this particular day. And maybe we can discover what it means that Harry posed the question about.
Which question?
Harry posed the question, what is meant by the 7-day creation cycle is a key to prayer absolute.
Oh yeah, there you go. Sure. Yeah, this is true, David. What David's saying.
Looking at each day as if it's a day in eternity.
Yes,
like, well,
this is what the Easter day practice was. It wasn't necessarily to do something that I had never done before. It was something that I was quite familiar with, and actually it needed to be something that I was competent to do. But it was to invoke this sacred presence or sense of the sacred that David's talking about, that this is the sacred, you know, doorway to my bedroom that I'm going through, and this is the sacred bathroom, and this is the sacred breakfast, and now comes the sacred car ride, and then whatever it is, you know, or the sacred computer turn on, right? You know,
because then you'll see that
the sacred feeding the cats. You said,
and you'll see people that will enter your space. Then will be very different entities. It'll wake you up to see that when somebody comes into your space, that in itself will be of interest to you. Whenever that person comes into your space, they came in at exactly the right moment. For whatever reason they did, that's what occurred. And you will know that. But you'll wonder at it. And if you do this properly, there will be this sense of awe and there's a gratitude to it. There's also this tinge, I don't want to get dramatic, but there's a tinge of this fear and trembling in it. Because it's like, oh my gosh, this is what was brought forth. And then you will respect that event, that individual, that color. Give it a shot and we'll see what happens during the week. And we'll take it up next week. Wednesday night.
Thank you, David and Ivan.
Thank you, guys.
Is there a week that we're going to skip?
We're going to go ahead and do this next week.
Thanks, Aria.
We're going to go ahead and do it. I was going to skip it, but we're not going to skip it.
Okay. Yeah. So we're good for next week.
Or, Harry, hang on for a moment, okay? George, hang on.
Sure.